Welcome to episode 333 of the Microsoft Cloud IT Pro Podcast, recorded live on May 5th, 2023. This is a show about Microsoft 365 and Azure from the perspective of IT pros and end users, where we discuss a topic or recent news and how it relates to you. Today, we start out by giving our opinions on Teams and Outlook opening links in Microsoft Edge and talk a little bit about some other browsers before diving into Azure AD news. In this last week, there have been a few announcements around Azure AD with the preview release of Windows Labs for Intune and Azure AD, as well as Azure AD Certificate-Based Authentication, or CBA, on mobile now being generally available. I'm curious what you think about this. I've seen the headlines. I think I understand what's going on with this. But I don't know that there's any demos out. It was more of an announcement in the Message Center. And I've seen a few people ranting and raving about this. Is Microsoft Teams plans to make users open links in Edge. And apparently this is both Microsoft Teams and Outlook, that when there's a link in one of those two programs, it's going to force you to open it in Edge. And everybody is up in arms that Microsoft is now forcing Edge on people. However, based on how I'm reading this, it sounds like it's doing it like Edge within Outlook and Teams, because it talks about opening, like say you get a link in a message. I email you a link or I send you a link in Teams and you click on it to open it. Instead of popping up like a brand new browser window, it sounds like from this announcement that it's popping it up within Teams or within Outlook.
It's popping it up in Edge.
It's in Edge and it's showing, because it talks about showing things side by side. So it's popping it up in Edge and then showing Teams and the link side by side.
You know the new Office browser bar that's on like the right side in Edge? So it pops open with the email. Say I clicked a link from an email. It has that email in Outlook WebView and then the link rendered on the left.
Browser bar?
Yes.
So the page is in the main area and then the Teams conversation or the Outlook is in that little toolbar thingy on the right.
Yes.
Okay, then they're probably justified that that's stupid.
Yeah, it's not a good way to do it.
Yeah, and I didn't look. I kind of skimmed through the articles and I couldn't tell from the articles and what I had seen if it was popping it in the client or popping it in the browser itself. I would agree, this should not pop it in the browser. You should have an option. Okay, we can be done with that one now. But I'm surprised they're trying this because I feel like they always get in trouble with their browsers and trying to force their browsers on everybody. And then the EU goes and slaps them on the wrist and they have to go undo it all. And then they go try to redo it again, like a few years later. I like a lot of Microsoft stuff, but I've heard, what is it? The definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again.
Yes.
And not learning from it's something like that. And not learning from it.
I just don't know sometimes about these things. You know, like last week we chatted about the marketing messages for conferences showing up in Teams and SharePoint and all these various applications. And this is very much in the same vein kind of thing. Like, don't give me marketing for your own stuff. Or like, it's great. It's fine. If you want to be helpful. But as soon as I turn it off, don't come and try and be helpful again and again and again and again behind me kind of thing. Like, stop forcing it down my throat. It's like Edge is, for the most part, it's like a decent browser, but becomes a really degraded experience when all of a sudden, hey, here's the new Office bar, on the right side of Edge, when maybe you're not an Office user. Like, not everybody is. Maybe you don't need that. Maybe you don't want the big Bing button there by default. Maybe in the enterprise version of Edge, like, you don't want to have Bing shopping bot following you around and offering you coupon suggestions. Like, it's kind of a hodgepodge thing, right? Like, and it's very, like, Microsoftian. That it's one of those everything in the kitchen sink kinds of products. I think it's really unfortunate that they do that at the expense of user experience. Like, you know, if you want to be a viable replacement for Chrome, you got to be less creepy than Chrome, not more creepy. And it's all going the other way, which isn't the best way.
Yeah, I was hoping Edge was going to be nice. Although I will be honest, Scott, I have been using Arc. Have you played around with the Arc browser at all?
I have played around with Arc a little bit. So you sent me an invite to it. So Arc today is a Mac OS only. Yeah, web browser. And it's going to come to other platforms at some point. I don't know if you saw this. So
yes. And there was a tweet today about it, hinting that it was going to come to Windows, like in the relatively near future.
I will put a link to a Reddit thread on Arc. So Arc as a browser is interesting. If anybody wants an invite, hit up Ben on all the socials and he'll help you out. Or I guess I have a couple invites now as well that I'm probably not going to use for anything.
Yeah, you have some now too, but either of us.
It's an interesting browser. It's an interesting take on the concept of a browser and having spaces within a browser and bringing, I think, like PWAs kind of in line into a browser. It's kind of interesting, like the way you interact with your mail versus YouTube versus a set of web pages that are in like a tab group, which is a space, things like that. One of the cool things the Arc team is doing is, or they're going to try and do, I have no idea if they'll be successful on this. So for Arc on Windows, they're basically going to build their own custom, like bundled version of Swift and bring that over to Windows. So it's kind of this this is very ambitious thing that they want to go ahead and do. So they want to build a Swift toolchain for Windows. And sometime in 2023, the timing isn't exact. But basically what they want to do is they want to build their own custom compiler and debugger for Swift on Windows. They also want to build a native VS Code integration and build a bridge layer to do Swift bindings over to the built-in WinApp SDK. And then they, once they have all that in place, right, like they can port their code over, they can compile, debug, all those kinds of things, they will actually be ready to port Arc over to Windows. So basically what they're looking to do is design, build, and ship a toolchain to develop cross-platform Mac and Windows apps that are programmed in Swift using Visual Studio Code. The Arc team, which is the underlying organization that runs it, it's called the Browser Company. It's not a big company. It seems like a very large endeavor to go ahead and push through. But we shall see how it goes and where it lands. I mean, I wish them, you know, best of luck. It's always cool to see new technology come through like that. I imagine there's a whole host of wonkiness that comes along the way with that.
For sure. And I've been using it for 2 weeks now. I've been really liking it. I won't lie. I set it to my default browser. I'm like, okay, I'm going to dive into this for 2 weeks and try it. I've actually been a big fan of it, and I have no intention at this point in time of switching back. We'll have to see. It's been a good experience for me to this point in time. I have a guest on the podcast with me today, Black Eyed Jack. He tried to catch a swing with his face. It did not work out so well. For those of you that can see.
I see the lock on your door is working really well too.
It worked. Well, I didn't lock it. So it's just me and him home for a couple days while the rest of the family's out. And I didn't want to lock him out of my office since there's no one else here.
Security through obscurity. I got it.
Yes. Let us know about the Arc browser. So I was going to mention this. I want to go back to the Edge thing and then we'll dive into our Azure AD topic. So how come Microsoft gets into all this trouble for it and Apple got away with like forcing Safari on you on all their devices for so much longer? And even the iPhone, I mean, you can switch it now, right? On the iPhone, iPad, it sort of lets you switch your default browser and you still see all this stuff about opening Safari and then it opens in the default browser. But to be fair, Apple forced Safari on mobile devices for a really long time and never really got this type of blowback, I guess, from the community that Microsoft does when they try to force Edge. I don't think either one is right. I don't think Apple should do it. I don't think Microsoft should do it. I want to be able to pick what I want. But that aspect of it has always befuddled me.
They're very different things, very different ecosystems and different units of scale when you measure them. So I guess for Apple, when you say they used to force people into Safari, they still do. So WebKit is the underlying rendering engine on iOS. If you're a third-party browser maker, like say you're Microsoft building Edge for mobile,
or Edge, Google Firefox, building Chrome
for, yep, for iOS, you still have to use Apple's WebKit rendering engine in the background. So you're basically a shell on top of Safari.
On top.
And that's the state of affairs today. So until Apple builds in sideloading or something else, like you really can't bring your own rendering engine. Like Google couldn't bring Chrome over with Blink or something like that. I think some of it is you and I live in the United States where it's very much like an Apple bubble. Like iOS is a popular thing here. Like everybody I know who has a phone has an Apple device, like, and but I mean, I've got them all over my, like, I got an Android phone sitting next to me, but I only have it sitting on the desk for like testing and playing around. I don't use it day to day. Like, my daily driver is an iPhone, and I've got iPads and all those kinds of things. As soon as you get outside of the United States, that's not the case at all. Like,
it's all Android,
yeah. From a pure, like, hey, let's take a look at the global market and kind of economies of scale and things that are going on out there, Android is magnitudes larger than iOS. It's absolutely the right thing to do to say, like, hey, like, why is it this way? But saying why is it this way because like Apple's got a monopoly isn't really, I don't know that it's the best lens to look at it through.
That it's that because there's such a small market share compared to the people using Teams and Outlook and Edge getting forced on them. And I guess to your point, a lot of this stuff ends up coming down from the EU, not anything in the US. And if Android's or Apple's not that big over in the EU, they probably aren't caring that much about it.
I just real quick kind of Googled around for a quick one here. So mobile operating system share worldwide in Q1 2023 was Android at 71.65% of the global market and iOS at 27.71%.
I guess that makes sense, sort of. Although I still think it should be, if one gets in trouble, the other one should too. But anywho, we don't need to spend our entire time talking about browsers.
Browsers are fun. They're not a bad thing to talk about.
And they're very quickly turning into the center of everything we do. Like, I look at the amount of time I spend in the browser, and even the amount of time I could spend in the browser. If I didn't care about desktop Outlook or Office apps, I could probably legitimately spend like 95% of my day just in a browser and do all of my work right in the browser and websites and all of that, which is why I need like 16 gigs of RAM dedicated just for my browser.
It's an interesting thing. So I don't know if you've noticed this in just kind of the change in the way you collaborate with people. I was doing something earlier this week. We were talking about Power BI and they wanted some help putting together some Power BI reports. Like, they've never done Power BI.
I know where this is going.
I was like, okay, cool. Like, happy to show you. And, you know, let's set up some time, put some time on my calendar. Like, we'll go through it and do it all. And we were kind of talking about prerequisites. Like, what are the things that you should have in place ahead of time to make sure that this is a useful session for us? So, you know, that Excel notebook that has the tabular data, make sure you have that available, put it in a shared location on SharePoint or your OneDrive, make sure you bring your Kusto queries, your SQL queries, like all those things, like bring those to the conversation.
Yep.
And oh, by the way, bring Power BI as well.
Windows.
And when you say that to somebody and they're living in a web-first world, like, it was a little bit of a... The first question I got wasn't like, do I need the desktop app? It's like, can I start from the web? I'm like, no, let's not do that. Like, let's go get the desktop app here. There's a 64-bit version of it. Have fun. Please, like, go grab that thing.
Yeah.
And it's a different way to think about it. Like, in the world of PWAs, all these kind of mobile-first things, like, I guess I come from a place where I'm app first for everything. Like I do everything I can not to use a website first. And I'm slowly recognizing that there's this whole other universe of folks out there, back to Android versus iOS, right? People approach things in different ways that,
right.
Yeah, like that it's not a desktop first world. It's a mobile and specifically like online, like web-based world first. That's a big pivot point for me in my head, right? And it's something I really have to like try and wrap my head around and be able to grasp.
So I would be fascinated if we can find somebody that has some insight into Power BI, why it has actually reverted, unless you know why it's reverted to a Windows app first. Because I remember when Power BI first came out, I was able to do a lot more in the browser then than I am today. In terms of like setting up data connections and creating those initial dashboards and the Power Query and all of that, I distinctly remember doing all of that in the browser. And one day I went in to do it and I was like, wait a minute, it's all gone in the browser. I actually have to start in the desktop app now. For 99% of what you do in Power BI, you absolutely need Windows. You need to go download the desktop app in Windows 10, Windows 11, do everything there, publish it up to Power BI, and then you can make minor tweaks in the browser. But I feel like that's one app that has actually gone backwards from the functionality available, at least from the creation authoring standpoint, and what was available on the web to having to be more desktop first. I don't know, maybe it is, it's the massive amount of data or the processing. I'm curious if you know or if anybody knows that is listening.
I don't know. I would bet a couple of things. So there's actually a pretty decent comparison on the differences between Power BI Desktop and Power BI the service, kind of like the website that you would go to if you were going to be web first. So one of the things that really stands out to me there is being able to not only transform your data, but also shape and model it. And I think that's going to be better suited to desktop apps, especially the way Power BI does it today, right? Like where you might have a backend view for your data sources, and then you actually have your modeling view, and you have this kind of relationship structure that can be changed on the fly. And sometimes it can be one-to-one, one-to-many, many-to-many. You can have bi-directional things. Like, honestly, like that's not something I want to mess around with in a Microsoft interface for doing like data modeling on the web. Like I've already tried Visio on the web and that's horrible. Like for things like that, I don't even want to do it with a live connection, having to tie things together. I think another big part of it is probably just performance and kind of perf and scale. So when you're doing things like you're, say, creating a new DAX measure or you're creating calculated columns, you are really kind of asking the local client to do a whole lot on the fly. Like usually when I'm working with Power BI reports, I'm working with data sets with at least a million rows, if not tens of millions sometimes. So it's not an inconsequential amount of data to have to churn through and kind of figure out. Like I wouldn't want to have the overhead of waiting for my web browser to render something. Like it's bad enough having to wait for the Power BI desktop app to catch up with you. And then the final one that stands out to me is data sources. And there's always been this disparity between Microsoft tooling and in the ability to bring in data sources. So things like, well, take like Excel on the Mac versus Excel on Windows and what you can do with being able to do a linked data source and like pull in a Kusto connection or connect to another notebook and bring in data, things like that. Like it's a varied experience there and it's really limited by the client and what it can connect to. So I'm willing to bet that you can just write a whole ton of different connectors on desktop and iterate on top of them much quicker on the desktop side than you can on the service side. And then on the service side, like you don't need the authoring connector experience. You really just need to support like the gateway or connectivity piece. Like you're almost down to like ports and protocols at that time over the actual like engine to do all the stuff. So,
right. And then I guess from the data refresh standpoint, if you're doing scheduled refreshes or manual refreshes, you're not as worried about it refreshing quite as quick because you're not trying to actively work with the data live to formulate it. It's just go refresh all the data, re-render, and if you're doing a daily refresh at 5 a.m. or 11 p.m. Who cares if it takes 15 or 20 minutes to do a data refresh?
Exactly.
I guess that I can see that. And yeah, I wonder if that was part of the web stuff. Is it just was too slow? It was taking too many resources on the back end. And they said, let's just author it all on the desktop.
I don't know if you've noticed, but for all the web apps that Microsoft pushes on us, they're not always the most performant things. Like, given the choice of working in Google Sheets versus Excel, I would want to work in Google Sheets every day. Does it do everything Excel does? No. Does it work fast and consistently? Yes. Can I say the same about Excel on the web? I cannot. Same thing for Gmail and Outlook, Teams versus Slack, all these things, right? They're tools for the masses that have known rough edges and you just kind of live with them and plot along.
Yeah. Well, and I think some of the difference there, I'm going to assume between Excel on the web, Outlook. I mean, Microsoft came from a server first on-premises, non-web application first scenario and kind of has molded all their applications to work on the web versus all these newcomers. Google's been around for a while, but even them, G Suite, Slack, all of those kind of started with internet first, browser first, web first mindsets, I would say.
Very much so.
Where Microsoft has evolved from desktop to web. Do you feel overwhelmed by trying to manage your Office 365 environment? Are you facing unexpected issues that disrupt your company's productivity? IntelliJink is here to help. Much like you take your car to the mechanic that has specialized knowledge on how to best keep your car running, IntelliJink helps you with your Microsoft Cloud environment because that's their expertise. IntelliJink keeps up with the latest updates in the Microsoft Cloud to help keep your business running smoothly and ahead of the curve. Whether you are a small organization with just a few users up to an organization of several thousand employees, they want to partner with you to implement and administer your Microsoft Cloud technology. Visit them at IntelliJink.com/podcast. That's IntelliJink.com/podcast for more information or to schedule a 30-minute call to get started with them today. Remember, IntelliJink focuses on the Microsoft Cloud so you can focus on your business. So, all that being said,
that was a good rant for you.
That was a good rant. Do you want to talk about Azure AD today too?
Yeah, we can probably fit in some Azure AD stuff.
Fit in some Azure AD stuff. So this is one, Scott, this was end of April. Really, I guess only a week ago. And this is an interesting one because I've actually had a couple of clients come to me and directly ask for this. They came from the on-premises Windows management world, GPO servers, AD, domain connected to computers, all of that, and asked for... They're like, what's Microsoft's alternative if you're going to do Azure AD for LAPS or this local administrator password management and setting all that up? And there wasn't a good story. I've come up with workarounds where you could do a request with a user account that had its password recycled nightly and was a device admin in Azure AD. But then... really, you're sharing the same account among all your devices. So it's not really local. It's like if you actually knew what was going on, you'd be able to use that administrator password on any machine, not just your own. But within the last week, Windows has now rolled out Windows LAPS feature into public preview for Intune and support for hybrid Azure AD or Azure AD joined. So if you're looking for this local administrator password feature and being able to roll this out, again, not GA yet, but in preview, you can now do this natively within Azure AD. And they have a good article. We'll post it out here. Pretty straightforward in terms of going in and setting up your device settings in Azure Active Directory, going under account protection and setting up a LAPS, Windows LAPS, local admin password solution within one of your endpoint security profiles, and then going in and setting up some of the basic information around password complexity, administrator account name, password lengths, post-authentication actions. So there's quite a few configuration options you get right out of the gate. How long password age days are in there, backing up the password, where you want to back up the password to, Azure AD only, or I'm going to guess Active Directory is another option in here. But this article does a good job at kind of walking through how you would set all of this up with Intune. I will say it is Intune, so you are going to need Azure AD Premium. This is not one you're just going to get for free out of the gate.
Interestingly enough, you can do it without Intune.
Can you?
You can.
I did not see that in the article. I missed it. It's a long article.
It's not in the article, but it is in the official documentation.
Like the Learn documentation?
Yeah. So a couple of things. So client support for this, if you're going down and you mentioned preview status, which usually implies you've got some kind of subset of clients out there that it's going to work with. You do need to be on specific versions of Windows clients. So Windows 10, you have to be on the April 2023 update, April 11, 2023. Same for Windows 11, both 21H2 and 22H2. There were also updates released on April 11 for those. And then you need to be on Windows Server 2022, or Windows Server 2019. So as long as you meet those kinds of things, you're okay. So the actual article for getting started with this, it has a call out in there. If your devices are Azure Active Directory joined, but you are not using Microsoft Intune, you can still deploy Windows Labs for Azure Active Directory. In this scenario, you must deploy policy manually. For example, either by using direct registry modification or by using local computer group policy. And that's about it. So yeah, you can do it without Intune. It's just going to take more on your side to get it done.
More work. Well, and that is an interesting note, because if you're looking at the very top, under the prerequisites for Labs, it is an Intune subscription as a prerequisite. But apparently that's like an optional prerequisite then based on how you want to push it out. And then Azure Active Directory free, which is the free version, which makes sense. And I guess here it does kind of say it under there too. With Azure AD free, you can still use all the features of Labs, but it's more, like you said, then buried further down. It's the automatic policy deployment aspect of it that you would get with Intune.
Yes, your experience is going to be different when it comes to policy management, policy creation, all those kinds of things. But if you are not Intune inclined and you're like, ooh, this is interesting, there is a path forward there.
Well, and I guess the nice thing about that path forward is you could test it out. Like if you have a couple devices, you want to see how this works, test it all out without having to use Intune to push out the policy. Go test it on your device, set up Labs, see how this works, set it up on a test device if you really like it and you don't want to manually push it out to all your clients. Go look at Intune. I'm curious, so not trying to skirt licensing requirements, what would happen if you'd go get the Intune trial because you wanted Labs for all your devices, pushed it out to all your devices, and then let your trial subscription expire? Like, technically, the policy's still there, right? Obviously, new devices, if you don't have Intune, it wouldn't push them out to new devices.
Yes.
But I don't know that it has to continually call back.
That's a good question. I don't know what policy peelback looks like when a trial ends. Does the service reach out right before? I don't know. It's a good question.
Ends. Somebody test that out, because I'm not about to test that out anywhere because I don't want to blow up a bunch of devices unless I go stand one up and just try it.
Shoot your shot.
I'm trying to think if I've had some. I don't think it actually peels it back, because I think it's a lot like GPO. I mean, GPOs stay applied. You wouldn't get any new updates to it. But once you push out those settings and update, because really it's updating the registry, right? It's not like it's reading it live. It's updating the registry. The registry is going to stay set until it says, don't update the registry anymore.
Correct. Yep.
Yeah. But like you said, once your Intune's gone, any new devices, any changes to it, if you ever wanted to pull it back, you'd be out of luck. But this was a nice one to see come. Again, especially because I've had a couple of clients come and ask for this directly. They're like, we're all Azure AD joined. We use Labs on-prem. We don't have on-prem anymore. What's our solution? It's hacky. You can make some stuff work, but it's definitely not anywhere near that functionality that you would normally get with Labs.
Yeah. So I can think of like beyond just base deployment, the other nicety that you would get out of having Intune licensing here is going to be reporting, both at the device level. So, hey, did this like individual device have this thing pushed to it, and how is it configured? What's its state?
Yep.
But there's a effectively like a workbook. I guess it's a dedicated workbook inside of your endpoint management in Intune for Windows lapse management as well. So not only can you see at the individual device level and report there and see what's happening, but you can also get the all up aggregate view of your kind of device posture and how that deployment has gone for you, which is probably more than a little annoying to do in any kind of like at scale way, you know, if you've got more than a handful of clients.
Yeah, well, and the other thing with Intune is you get all the other Intune features, right? You can go take advantage of conditional access and all your other policies and all of that. Non-lapse related.
Absolutely.
But there's a lot of benefits to Intune. And did you also see, Scott, this is one of the first times I think I've seen this, that this is also supported for GCC High. Like, day one, it came out to the public cloud and GCC High at the same time.
That is a new one. I don't think I've seen that too much.
No, it is. I'm guessing it's because I don't know that there's actually much new here. I mean, Windows Lapse has been there forever. You've been able to do it with GPO, and it's really just bringing that policy. And then there are a couple features that came, like the password retrieval is within Azure AD. But I think a lot of times with GCC High, it's because they have to get certifications for new features or new code or some of that. And I'm wondering if this was straightforward enough that there was not many hoops to jump through for approval for GCC. Or maybe GCC is the one that's always been asking for this, so they just did it for everybody at once. Because I can also imagine that this would be a feature that a lot of those GCC High, GovClouds, all of those different types of higher security tenants would actually really want or be interested
in. Where did you see the note about GCC High? I don't see it in any of the, at least the doc that you had shared.
It is not in the doc I shared. It's in another doc. I will send you this one. It's in is that the documentation? It's in the Learn documentation.
Oh, it's under, specifically under Intune support. I see it there.
GCC High right there. So what else has come to Azure AD, Scott? There's been a few more GCC High, or not GCC High, but oh, there's been a few more Azure AD things that have come out in the last few days. Do you want to do one more?
Sure, we can do one more. I think there's a bunch. So I'll put a link in the show notes. There's actually an article that was published about a whole bunch of Azure AD / Entra features that came out. One of the more interesting ones that kind of came across was the ability to do certificate-based authentication with mobile devices. This is something that was at least certificate-based authentication or CBA was announced back at Ignite 2022. So it's been kicking around for a while now, but now it is also generally available on mobile. So the cool thing here is it supports not only on-device certificates, but you can also do external security keys. So that could be like your NFC YubiKey, your iOS or your Android device, all that good kind of stuff. So I think for BYOD customers, like bring your own device, this is a really nifty capability to have.
Yeah, I had missed, I saw the headline. I had not had a chance to read this article yet before today because it came out yesterday. But yeah, the Azure AD CBA on iOS mobile with the YubiKey, CBA on Android with the YubiKey. I'm going to have to go play with this one a little bit and test it out. But this is another one. I do have clients that use CBA, especially mobile devices, being able to push out cert-based auth for, and they do it for a lot of their email, being able to push email config out to manage devices using cert-based auth. So this is one we're going to have to look at trying to start rolling out and playing with there.
I always like giving you a new task to add to your sticky note list.
To go play my sticky note list that never gets any shorter because you add them quicker than I can get them done.
That's the one.
Yeah, that is a good one. And now, Scott, it's time to go automate our podcast synopsis with Azure OpenAI GPT. This was another article that came out. I haven't read it. It's a whole article from Microsoft and how you can do pod abstracts with Azure Cognitive Services and OpenAI. We should try this. We can get synopsises. You don't need to write our 2-sentence podcast descriptions anymore. You can let OpenAI do it for you.
You can let OpenAI do it for you. You can do, I've seen folks do this with Whisper. I don't know if you've played around with Whisper at all yet.
I've not played with Whisper yet.
So Whisper is an AI-juiced transcription engine for audio. So you take like a WAV file and you pump it into Whisper and it runs a model on top of it and it spits out SRTs, TXTs. You know, like if we wanted to caption our YouTube videos for this podcast, we should really just slam them through Whisper and let them go and do its thing. And it'll do a better job than like auto captioning in YouTube or anything like that. So yeah, you can totally just take the output from something like Whisper and pump it into ChatGPT and then have it come back with a summary for you. It's kind of interesting. I don't know if you've been paying attention. Like one last quick digression here. We talked about Home Assistant a couple weeks back, and all the Home Assistant updates that have been coming out lately are focused on really like voice improvements, which I think is kind of interesting. So they've started to add all these kind of base layers and plugins to Home Assistant for being able to do voice integrations in multiple ways. So one is, you know, like if you're talking to your little device in the other room, you want to say like, hey device, do this. So your device basically needs to do voice transcription and bring that back and pull it back. So the way the Home Assistant folks are doing it is they're using some of these open source models and transcription engines like Whisper to actually do that translation, which is kind of cool. So like the latest versions of Home Assistant basically have Whisper built in. So that's when you're talking, say, to your mobile device and you're signed into the app and you're saying like, hey, do this, do this, do this. It's actually taking that and it's recording that audio in real time, passing it through Whisper, getting an output back. And then they're using large language models to take your request, like, hey, Dingus, turn on the lights in the living room, and run it through an LLM to have it output a common command. So if I say, hey, Dingus, turn on the lights in the living room, and you say, hey, Dingus, turn on the living room lights, those ultimately mean like the same thing. But there's probably just one common shortened command to push them through. So they're doing it both ways. They're taking human voice and they're transcribing it. And then they're taking the transcriptions and they're passing them into AI models. And they're having the AI models distill down to common commands that then can be executed within like Home Assistant as an engine, which is actually like totally, it was kind of like, I was like, oh yeah, like that's how all these things ultimately work at the end of the day. But it was kind of cool to see it just spelled out that way. So I'll have to see. I saw some good videos on YouTube about the latest update. I'll see if I can pop one in the show notes for you.
All right. It'll be interesting to look at that and see how that continues to change over the coming months and years. So the captions, speaking of captions, I've been doing them in YouTube, Scott, and I need to go look. DaVinci Resolve is what I use to do the editing of our YouTube videos. And in their latest version, they came out with 8.5 beta 1. They added right in there generating captions from the audio. And I don't know if they're using Whisper or something else in the back end, but I can go edit all our podcasts, edit the podcast together, and then say, go make captions for me from the audio tracks, and it adds a caption track in there. And then when I export it, I can export the caption track as a VTT, and they have like 4 or 5 different caption file types that you can generate. So I've been doing it, but I just do it right alongside editing the video, because even these video editing tools are starting to build that language transcription right in.
I forget which model they use in DaVinci, but they kind of made it like the service Descript, if anybody has ever played around with that.
Yeah, I didn't look. I just saw it showed up in there. So I was like, I should go get
that. I don't think they're using Descript in the background, but it's totally something Descript-ish. So the DaVinci stuff I've seen, I haven't played with it in person. Like, you probably got more hands-on with it than me. But from what I've seen of it, it's basically doing the same kind of thing. Take the audio, translate it through, put it into the text. But then the really cool thing, like the nifty thing about something like Descript as an engine. So Descript is basically an audio, really like kind of spoken word, very like podcast focused thing. But it lets you just in real time edit text, and then it does like the underlying clip edits for you on the other side. So if you wanted to, you know, strike an entire sentence out, you just strike the sentence in Descript, and then it strikes all that audio, automatically clips it and shortens it up and does all that stuff. And DaVinci is doing something very similar.
It is. It's kind of nifty. They haven't gotten to the point yet in 8.5 where they let you edit the audio based on editing the subtitles. And I just looked, and I don't know that it's only been within the last 2 weeks that they came out with this update. And I don't know if they even said what they're using in the background to do it. But I have seen some of those tools that let you edit your audio by editing the text. And it is pretty nice because then you can just search the text for all the times you went, and delete them all and quickly remove that from your audio.
Yeah.
But with that, Scott, I should probably let you go. I have a feeling my son is trying to lock me in my office because he shut the door and I hear things being tied on the doorknob.
All good stuff. So I'll let you go to it. As always, thanks for the time, Ben. I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, Scott. We'll talk to you again next week.
Yep. Bye.
If you enjoyed the podcast, go leave us a 5-star rating in iTunes. It helps to get the word out so more IT pros can learn about Office 365 and Azure. If you have any questions you want us to address on the show or feedback about the show, feel free to reach out via our website, Twitter, or Facebook. Thanks again for listening and have a great day.